You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. Torre Reed, professor of history at Illinois State University. His book, Toward Freedom, The Case Versus Race Reductionism. Meanwhile, Trump's assault on inspector generals continues unabated. Protesters tear gassed in Minneapolis as four officers fired over the killing of an unarmed black man, George Floyd. Department of Justice drops insider trading investigations of Loeffler, Inhofe, and Feinstein. A new report, Trump White House quashed OSHA regulation process that would have called for hospital respiratory pandemic readiness. Who needs it? Meanwhile, Trump calls for Republican House members to vote no on the Pfizer reauthorization, presumably because it doesn't mention Obamagate. GOP sues to stop proxy voting in the House. Trump's USDA is gearing emergency food assistance away from blue states in the Northeast. Trump says the Health and Human Services will cap Medicare insulin costs next year. Our government and money helped develop the potential coronavirus treatment. But surprise, surprise, we will have no say whatsoever in what it will cost, nor shall we participate in its profits. Lastly, Alabama COVID infections surge 2 weeks after restaurants opened. Imagine that. All this and more on today's program that we will be doing right now. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. I hope you're doing okay. This, we're heading into the malaise part of the, I think for, I don't know, maybe it's different in every part of the country. I keep hearing sort of like different reports of what's going on in California. Some people say they're not taking it that seriously, but they're, you know, they've been on top of it for quite a while. I imagine if you're in the Ozarks, you don't even realize anything is going on. But we shall see. We got a pretty good clip of, and you know, I have almost since the beginning of this program, I've had my issues with Andrew Ross Sorkin. I mean, certainly back in like the around the Occupy days, I remember critiquing a lot of what he had to say on television. But I appreciated this. I mean, look, the whole financial television world is in many respects, I don't know how to phrase this. The whole thing is sort of, there's a certain rancid quality to all of it, right? I mean, and not necessarily like, look, I don't begrudge anybody whatever kind of TV they want to watch or their hobbies or, you know, how to make more money or whatever it is. But because it's geared towards such a small sector of our society, and I'm saying this like literally, I mean, Fox Business, I think they may have less people watch their program on a given day, you know, at noon than watch this one. I think that's actually possible. But all the people who do, they're constantly in the market for a new, I don't know, whatever the car is, you know, fancy car. or whatever it is. And that's what CNBC does too. They drive their ad revenue not on the number of people who are watching, but on the incomes of the people who are watching. And so it's very much programming that is oriented toward these people. The people who host these shows are of that ilk, and their whole value system is a function of that. But it's nice occasionally to see at least some semblance of recognition of, like, that human beings are not just what did that libertarian say the other day? Like, the accountant from the White House, human capital or something to the, I don't
human
know.
Human capital stock.
Human capital stock. Here is Andrew Ross Sorkin. We show this exchange with that really odious Joe Kernan. And they have just like gone back and forth with a little bit with the news. And then I guess there's a little tension there because Sorkin has been too PC, as the president would say, because he's apparently, you know, encourages people to wear masks or something.
What will you tell us about what's happening
still
right now?
Still looking at the coincidence in Niagara. Okay, let's see. For a while, it was how can stocks be where they are because of oil prices? Remember, that was your take then.
Right.
How can it be based on where interest rates are right now? Then it could be how can stocks be? Right. And then it was every single discussion you have over the weekend is about how can stock prices be here when the economy is here? Right. Now it's going to be your earnings. But can you see how... That probably isn't the coincidence. The stuff Joe. Right in your face. We're going to have David Leibovitz on. He's going to say every client he talks to is asking him, how can the stock market be here when everything else is...
And that's the question.
Pause it for one second.
And there are a lot of smart people...
Listen, we know the answer. It's because they've poured trillions of dollars into this sector to prop it all up. And they just haven't done the same on the fiscal side. I mean, I don't know why they're, maybe it's like, it's partly because it's like, this is their religion. And they don't want to get on television and say like, oh, incidentally, like, you know, whatever. I don't know. He didn't really resurrect 3 days later, or they didn't really part the Red Sea, or, you know, the Easter Bunny isn't real. Nobody wants to say that. Make themselves feel bad and realize that all of their expertise is really just a function of how much money is being pumped into it. Good.
Have that view. You may
are
not
they?
Have that
are
view.
They, so, I know. That, you, how, you, why you, is that the smart people? They've been wrong for 35%. Why are they smart? Just because they can see what's right in front of their nose? That doesn't make them smart. It makes them.
Look,
it makes
Joe,
them
you
not
missed
savvy
it all the way
about,
down too.
Makes them
Joe,
not savvy about the
Joe,
market.
Joe, you missed it. You missed Joe. You missed it 100% on the way down, and you missed 100,000 deaths. So we can have this debate back and forth, and you can try to question the questions I'm asking. But there are smart people, including your friend Stan Druckenmiller, who has argued that the market has been
Hold on.
I'm not going to do this with you, Joe. Every morning you try to question the questions I'm asking. These are questions that investors are asking. Every single morning, I am just trying to get through some of this clutter. I may be right. I may be wrong. Investors may be right. They may be wrong. That's what makes a market. But it doesn't make people a good person or a bad person. It doesn't make it right to act the way you are. I'm sorry.
Okay. You yelled
and
at the poor guy
this
about
hour.
The guy
not,
yesterday with masks. Is like, why are you yelling at
I'm
me
not,
now?
Joe.
You just yelled again. I don't
I'm
know.
Not.
I'm just trying to.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, you're not. No, you're not, Joe. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead with the news.
You panicked about the market, panicked about COVID, panicked about the ventilators, panicked about the PPE, panicked about ever going out again, panicked
and
that we'd ever
Joseph,
get back to normal.
Joseph, you didn't panic
what good
about
is
anything.
That? What good is it? Why
Joseph,
not help people
die.
Keep their head? I understand
100,000 people died, Joe, and all you did was try to help your friend, the president. That's what you did. Every single morning on this show. Every single morning on this show. You abused and abused your position, Joe.
That's totally unfair.
You abused and abused your position.
I'm trying to help investors keep their cool, keep their heads. And as it turned out, that's what they should have done. That's what they should have done. They should have kept their heads. If they had listened to you, Andrew, we're supposed to be at about 8,000.
I wasn't arguing to go sell your stocks, Joseph. I was arguing about people's lives.
We understand.
People's lives.
Andrew, it's a global pandemic.
Do the news. I'm begging you to do the news, Joseph.
It's a global pandemic.
I'm begging you.
Andy,
please.
It's a global pandemic, Andy, where per capita deaths, we're down near the low end of per capita deaths. We're nowhere near per 100,000. Most places are at 60 deaths per 100,000. We're at 29. So it's terrible that we've lost 100,000 lives. It's terrible. But it was never going to be that we weren't going to come back and that we weren't going to return to normal. And, you know, siding with Ackman and everything else, that, you know, giving credence to all that panic didn't help any investors at all or people with their anxiety and everything else. So that's why we're here, to try and navigate people through, not trying to help Donald Trump. Anyway, let's look at Tesla. News.
There you go. Let's look at Tesla. You know, the complete, I think it's willful ignorance on this part of this guy to sort of recognize that the anxiety in the form of, you know, trying to convince people that this is real enough that you should go out and wear a mask if you go out, when you go out. The anxiety in terms of like, and what's also sort of shocking is like, this guy's talking like he's done some type of big public service to maintain the calm of investors. Meanwhile, there's 30 some odd million people without jobs. There are people who are worried about their unemployment benefits running out in a month and a half. People don't have health insurance. You've got frontline workers who have been devastated by this because of the failure of securing PPE. All of that is just sort of like secondary to the fact that we salvaged the market, which of course was just a function of the Fed pumping trillions of dollars into it with, you know, $500 billion worth of collateral from Congress. But there it is. Nice to see Andrew Ross Sorkin have a moment of humanity. I don't watch the show enough to know if he's more human like that. But, you know, relative to that guy, that Joe Kernan guy, it's nice to see at least just a little slight splash of that. Meanwhile, one of today's sponsors is BetterHelp. And they're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, via chat, via video. Now more than ever, folks, people could use this. I'm seeing a report. A third of Americans now show signs of clinical anxiety or depression. This is according to the Census Bureau, I guess. I know there's a piece in Washington Post, but a lot of therapists have long wait lists. It can take weeks or months before they can connect with you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and you'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. Once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you think it's not a good fit, super easy. You switch to a new one at any time. You can do so for any reason. No additional charge, nothing. They make it seamless. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country. They have therapists with specialties that may not be available in your area that you wouldn't even begin to know how to look for. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance when you use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/majority report. We're going to take a quick break, and we come back. We'll be talking to Dr. Torre Reed, professor of history from Illinois State University, toward freedom. The Case versus Race Reductionism. Be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Dr. Torre Reed. He is a professor of African American and 20th century history at Illinois State University, author Toward Freedom, The Case versus Race Reductionism. Torre, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
The book basically traces the policies that and how they impact Black folk in America and white folk in America for that matter starting with the New Deal through the Fair Deal and the Second Bill of Rights and then through the post-war period. And in some instances you use, Ta-Nehisi Coates as sort of an avatar of the changes that have taken place in the perspective of policies in the post-war era. Let's just start with the premise of your book because it basically, tries to deal with the a misconception of what liberals, I guess, a policy set has been towards dealing with race and specifically things like black poverty and social, I guess, socioeconomic problems.
Yes. Should I tell you a little bit about how I got, what prompted me to write the book?
Sure.
And what the impetus for writing the book was dated back to late 2015. And when I'd written an article that was for Jacobin magazine called Why Liberals Separate Race from Class. And the article was a response to a then commonplace misconception. And it was a critique of the Sanders campaign that was based on this commonplace misconception that liberal social policy had failed African Americans because liberals had purportedly been guilty of what people would call class reductionism, right? And class reductionism would refer to a tendency to treat as secondary issues that such as racism or sexism or fill in the blank, right? And so this claim that in late 2015, there was a claim that Sanders' redistributive agenda was, again, the latest iteration of a decades-long liberal tendency to ignore racism. And what struck me about that claim was that it was essentially a declaration of up is down. There is no doubt, if you are alive and paying attention, that post-war liberalism had failed to close, to bring an end to racial disparities, right? To close the racial wealth gap or to eliminate wage disparities. There's no doubt about that. But what was striking about, again, this characterization that post-war liberalism had failed blacks because of a tendency towards class reductionism, which Ta-Nehisi Coates is one of the most visible champions of that view, was it was tantamount to a declaration of up is down. Post-war liberalism had failed, again, to redress inequities, but it would have been more accurate to say that failure was owed to a tendency of liberals, to abstract racial disparities from the political and economic forces that engendered them in the post-war era, right? So in other words, post-war liberalism's failures were probably more accurately understood as a failure of race reductionism rather than class reductionism.
Okay, fair enough. And so you look at the New Deal and sort of, I guess, reinterpret it from the reinterpretation or the sort of the in fashion perspective on it as why African Americans who were maybe more likely to be domestic workers were left out of things like Social Security or agricultural workers. And you also go through the other, sort of, I guess, the home ownership policies. Tell us about those.
Sure. There's been an interesting evolution in the way that people talk about the New Deal and its limitations. And I think there's no doubt that the New Deal had its problems. But whereas in the 1980s and 1990s, there was a left critique of New Deal and post-war liberalism, which is the critique of New Deal and post-war liberalism that I was introduced to when I was in grad school, let's say, and in college. And it's certainly one that I hold firmly, which is that the New Deal certainly failed to extend the benefits and post-war liberalism failed to distribute their benefits evenly. Whites benefited more from, let's say, the National Labor Relations Act, right, which makes it easier for workers to join unions, or whites benefited unambiguously more from FHA mortgage policies, which essentially redlined blacks out of home ownership. But whereas left academics in the 1980s and 1990s, people like Michael Katz, people like Jill Cordano, people like Michael K. Brown, Adolph L. Reed, who, for the sake of full disclosure, is my dad, they had made the case, made this very case in the 80s and 90s, late 80s and 90s, at the dawn of, towards the end of Reaganism and beginning of Clintonism, that the welfare state had been critically important, not just to the expansion of the black middle class, which conservatives had certainly argued as part of their case against programs like affirmative action, but the welfare state had been even more important to the life chances of the white middle class, and that the principal beneficiaries, these leftists had argued, and again, the late 80s through the Clinton years, the principal beneficiaries of federal largesse were actually whites, and the white middle class was built, they'd argued, on the foundation of a welfare state. Those authors in that era had made this case not just in defense of protecting programs that benefited blacks disproportionately, such as AFDC, which we know Bill Clinton signed out of existence, but also affirmative action. They had also made a case for a truly universal set of redistributive programs, right? Because they argued that the New Deal's failures were owed in part to the fact that its universalism was far from universal, right? That there were exemptions, essentially, that precluded the moniker of universalism being assigned to the great universal New Deal programs. In more recent years, people who identify as leftists, interestingly enough, along with conservatives, have pointed to the deficiencies of the New Deal as a case against a welfare state, right? I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only person who's read a truckload of thought pieces on the racist origins, let's say, of the minimum wage, which actually the minimum wage did a lot to redress disparities in agriculture. Once the minimum wage was extended to agricultural workers, racial disparities in agriculture had diminished substantially, if not were fully eliminated, right? And a host of other such anti-statist, essays. And so the point that I'm making about the New Deal, which is, not a point that I can lay claim to, because it predates me by a lot, certainly predates me as a scholar by a lot, is that its inadequacies notwithstanding, now, at this very moment, the way that many people who identify as progressives have characterized it, really overlooks the critical importance of the New Deal to Black Americans. And likewise, and we can talk about the critical importance of the New Deal to Black Americans if you'd like, but it likewise plays into a right conservative assault on the kinds of policies that would be essential to eliminating things like, the racial wage gap, right? So this is the basic point that I make, which complicates our current understanding of the New Deal, but I want to stress that I'm not even the originator of such a narrative, right? I draw from other scholars.
Okay. All right. So fair enough. I mean, so I think the idea, but I mean, you're open to the critique of the New Deal as, the way that I perceive it is characterized is that, there was a certain amount of racism embedded in the way that the New Deal was passed, that, and that there were concessions made, arguably made to industry. Those industries wanted those concessions. I don't want to have to pay I don't want to have to pay taxes on my agricultural laborers, right? But that maybe it was race that provided the weak link where that would be where the concession went, right? Like where, water finds its lowest point on some level, that the pressures were most successful in those areas where they could trade off of race, which doesn't, in my estimation, diminish the value of the New Deal across the board, but does have that feature.
Well, I mean, let's go back to one of the policies that you mentioned in passing as the setup, because I would want to complicate the narrative that the New Deal's racial limits, and I think it's reasonable to cast them as such, insofar as blacks do not benefit equally from New Deal policies, and no one on the left has argued that they have. Actually, that's one of the things that makes them leftist rather than liberals. But let's take Social Security, for example, which is commonly understood. So there are exemptions in Social Security that exclude domestic and agricultural workers from the benefits of Social Security. There's no doubt that Southern legislators, right, Southern members of Congress had made racist arguments in defense of excluding those workers, you know, agricultural and domestic workers from Social Security coverage. But it's also quite apparent that the end game wasn't motivated, certainly not exclusively, and I would say not principally, by racism, and definitely not racism the way that people talk about it today, as if it's a demon that's inexorable, but rather it's very clear that large farmers, plantation owners, we'll call them, because that's what they were, had opposed the extension of Social Security coverage to agricultural workers, period, irrespective of race. And the clearest expression of this is that the majority of workers who were excluded by those exemptions, the majority of workers, the clear majority, over 70% of the workers that were excluded by from Social Security by way of the exemptions for domestic and agricultural workers were, surprise, surprise, white. And if you look at the position that the plantation owners and, of course, their farm lobby had staked out, it was, as you said, a desire not to pay taxes. But the fact of the matter is, it also included concern about the government treading on their managerial prerogatives. But the fact of the matter is that if 74% of the workers who are excluded from Social Security Act coverage, and specifically from those exemptions for domestic and agricultural workers were white, and 23% of those workers who were excluded by way of those exemptions were black, that has to complicate the narrative that the principal impetus behind the exclusion of those workers was white people's, all of them, visceral attachment to something that we might call white skin privilege. It's very clearly more complicated than that. And that complicating factor is not a pass. In fact, I would argue, as many leftists do, that what those exemptions from Social Security Act, and they apply to the Fair Labor Standards Act, which establishes overtime pay and a minimum wage. And there are even exemptions, of course, for agricultural workers that one gets from the National Labor Relations Act as well. But what those exemptions for Social Security and the Fair Labor Standards Act reveal as one of the crucial limitations of the New Deal, which was that its end game was essentially to write a listing capitalist economy. It worked certainly to the benefit of working people, but the end game of the New Deal was also to make a fairer and more sustainable model of capitalism, which put New Dealers in a position, and I would say many embraced it, and in which they sometimes made much greater concessions to capital than they made to workers, right? All the workers, all of the agricultural workers who were exempted from Social Security Act coverage were screwed, right? But again, I'm going to beat this dead horse. If 74% of the workers who were excluded from SSA coverage were white, then that tells you that it's got to be more than just racism. I'll add one other thing. There were about close to a dozen categories of workers who were exempted from Social Security coverage. I think the lion's share of workers who were covered worked in industry and commerce. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But many of those occupations in which that were exempted from Social Security coverage, like I believe medical doctors were exempted, let's say, blacks were quite underrepresented among the share of workers in those fields.
Fair enough. To attribute all of it to race obviously is belied by the 74% of white workers. And on some level, there's an analog in terms of the reassertion, you know, post Reconstruction, the reassertion of voting restrictions across the country, you know, like poll taxes and literary tests, literacy tests. Which would exclude, very often would exclude poor white people as well, African Americans. It's tough to divine the motivation of these people. I guess it's just a function of like, it was undoubtedly every industry wanted to be exempted, right? I mean, and every capitalist wanted to be the one who got their exemption, but the one who could leverage race as a cover on some level, maybe it was a cover, maybe it wasn't, but I mean, I think that there's certainly an argument that it was successful. And I think also, you know, from an FHA standpoint, it's not, you know, it's not quite as clear, but on some level, you know, if you don't have money to buy a house, you can't get a mortgage anyways. But the idea at that point is that the policies were certainly more oriented towards a class disposition than we saw following World War II.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I just want to go back to the excellent Reconstruction corollary you drew. I mean, there is a constant between the efforts of the conservative elements in the South, conservative Democrats, to press ahead on disenfranchisement by way of literacy requirements and a host of grandfather's clauses, et cetera, and between that and one column and the desire of agribusiness to exclude workers, sharecroppers, and other agricultural workers from Social Security coverage, and that's a desire to maintain managerial prerogatives, and of course the quest for cheap labor, right? And again, it's important not to lose sight of that, you know, end game. It's likewise important with respect to Social Security coverage, just for the sake of argument, to not lose sight of the fact that those exemptions to Social Security for agriculture and domestic workers ended in the 50s. So it wasn't an indefinite thing, and it's certainly not something that I would support had I been alive. But I do want to stress on that point that the American Farm Bureau, which was the largest agricultural lobby of the day, right, for, you know, in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, had not only opposed the extension of Social Security coverage to agricultural workers, they didn't want it for the land owning proprietors either. They didn't want to pay the tax, and they certainly didn't want the government intruding on their affairs, right? And that's not uncommon for various kinds of business. But agribusiness, I think, didn't imagine that they could weather the taxes effectively.
So
FHA mortgage policy is relevant too, and that's a very clear example of institutional racism. But I think it's also important not to lose sight of the fact that the redlining policies, which were horrendous, and in fact, one of the more despicable aspects of it is that it's not until the Civil Rights Act of 1968 that, you know, formal barriers to Black homeownership are eliminated, with, of course, some caveats. But nevertheless, the FHA policies in question were drafted with input from the real estate and banking industries. And that gets us right back to one of the critical problems of New Deal policy, was its deference to capital. It wasn't illustrative of the inherent limitations of white people en masse. It wasn't illustrative of the inherent limitations of government to do right by the citizenry. But it certainly was illustrative of the limitations of government to do right by the citizenry in the context of an end game of doing right by capital.
Right. And to a certain extent, though, too, it strikes me as, and I guess this is, you know, the central thesis of your book, that, you know, reductionism is wrong in this regard. But there's an interplay here, right, where capital wants to basically preclude this legislation, whatever legislation it is, from inhibiting its ability to profit. And it seems, at least in that era, and I would probably argue in certain other circumstances in our own, that it is most successful at doing that when it has, you know, race as one of its arrows in its quiver.
Well, certainly race functions as a vehicle for divide and conquer. But if those of us who understand ourselves to be liberals or progressive treat race as something that exists, that is a force of nature, right? If we treat race as something other than a human contrivance, as an ideology, And if we treat racism as something other than an expression of a commitment to race, the idea that there are biological or quasi-biological hierarchies, you know, that we call racial groups, then it's going to continue to function as a vehicle to undermine the end game for America's working people, right? If we think that race is something that just is an inexorable force of nature, and that racism by extension is an inexorable force of nature, then of course this will function as is its intent going back to the 19th century. And it, in this case, is race's intent as a vehicle for naturalizing, for reifying hierarchies that are, you know, the product of human contrivance, that they're organic to capitalism. But it's also going to function to continue to function to keep people numb to the realities of the real forces that are undercutting their livelihoods, their security in themselves, their ability to, you know, pay for their kids to go to college, or just again, maintain a stable and reasonable existence.
Let's get into when the shift happens in terms of the way that, I guess, your argument is the way that liberals approached socioeconomic disparities between races. There was a shift in the way that liberals address this.
Yeah. So in the post-war era, liberals become much less invested in economic inequality. They don't give up on it, obviously. And certainly what happens more to the point of, in terms of people's perception of racial inequities is that during the Cold War, liberals will gravitate less, will move away from political economic understandings of racial inequality and gravitate more and more to what I would call, you know, race reductionist models, but the race reductionist framework is pretty broad, to constructs that essentially treat race and attitudes as if they are real or inborn. And the matter of treating race as if it's real or inborn is complicated insofar as the language that liberals use in the post-war era to discuss racial inequality is culturalist. And culture and race aren't supposed to be the same thing, right? Race is a social construct. It's not a real biological category, but race is supposed to be a biological category. Culture is just how a population shaped by common experience views the world. And so culture is fluid and dynamic. Race, again, is supposed to be static. Culture, by contrast, is something that anyone can acquire through exposure and shared experience and just interacting with other people over time. The culturalist constructs that liberals tend to use in a post-war era to discuss racial inequality or to make sense of it actually aren't really culture so much in the anthropological sense of the word. They are much closer to what race is supposed to be, insofar as people like historian Oscar Hanlon, or maybe more importantly, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who I know that a lot of your listeners would be familiar with, when they attach themselves to constructs like ethnic pluralism and culture poverty, the way that they discuss ethnic identities and culture, and ethnic identities are cultural identities, they're not supposed to be, you know, biological identities, which is what race is supposed to be, right? So the way that they discuss ethnic group culture and culture poverty presumes that groups can have norms and worldviews that may originate in shared experience, but that become ingrained in them and essentially become the essence of what they are. And the moment you uncouple culture from the material world, you presume, again, that you could take a population or even individuals outside of its milieu and plop it someplace else, and they'll just remain what they were forever. That's not culture. That's race. So the constructs that post-war liberals tend to coalesce around to explain inequities really are essentially racialist constructs. There's culture attached to it, which implies fluidity. But when you look at how they think about inequality, it's really a lot more like race. And that allows liberals in the post-war era, like during the Johnson administration, to ignore the culture of poverty specifically allows liberals to diminish the impact of the structural changes that were taking place in the U.S. economy, the very structural changes that were taking place in the U.S. economy that civil rights activists at the March on Washington in 1963 demanded that President Kennedy and then eventually President Johnson pay attention to: automation and urban deindustrialization, which were having a disproportionate impact on blacks. Liberals during the war on poverty tended to diminish the impact of these structural changes on the U.S. economy and structural changes of the U.S. economy, the impact on blacks, and instead were more disposed to attribute black poverty to racial discrimination, which was a factor, and there's no question about that, but also the cultural deficiencies of the black poor themselves. And that framework, that culture poverty framework, again, functioned as an escape hatch to ignore the way that deindustrialization and automation were having a disproportionate impact on blacks. And it is worth stressing that while someone like Daniel Patrick Moynihan is celebrated today, you know, from the 80s to this very day for his prescience and for seeing the failure of the war on poverty to eliminate black poverty, it's stunning that he is celebrated for his prescience when leftists like A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin, who were the two principal organizers of the 1963 March on Washington, and also put together what was called the Freedom Budget for All, other leftists like Michael Harrington and Charles Killingsworth and a host of others had likewise predicted that the war on poverty's emphasis simply on anti-discrimination policies, which again were very, very important, but insufficient.
Right.
And of course, efforts to provide cultural tutelage to poor blacks and other poor people. When they predicted that those policies would fail because of deindustrialization, we don't remember that. Right. And I know that all of your listeners know that we haven't lived under an economy in the U.S. that has been an industrial economy for decades at this point. Right. The process of deindustrialization dates back to the 1950s. And yet we don't think about the disproportionate impact of deindustrialization, the decline of the union movement as well on blacks and other low skilled workers. We should.
Can you give like some examples of those policies and how they were specifically directed at what was ostensibly a culture of poverty, which you would argue is really sort of more racialist, in service of the necessary but insufficient argument that you're making?
So if you're asking, like you're talking about like during the Johnson administration?
Yeah.
For example, so like programs like Job Corps, which was not without some value, or community action programs, also not without some value, presumed that the hardcore unemployed lacked not just the hard skill sets to gain access to meaningful, gainful employment, but they also lack the soft skill sets. And so those programs, which again, I don't think were entirely without value because they do provide MDTA, I think would be another, they do provide job training, and job training is useful if the jobs are there.
Right.
The problem was that from 1953 or so forward, the U.S. experienced a decline in the number of well-paying jobs for low-skilled workers, and these would be well-paying unionized jobs for low-skilled workers, that had been the pathway that working-class whites had taken from the tenements to the suburbs. And so training people for jobs that may or may not exist and don't exist, ultimately, isn't really the best approach. People like A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin and Charles Killingsworth and even W. Willard Wirtz, who was Secretary of Labor, Moynihan was his assistant, they had advocated for public works. I mean, actually taking a page from the book of the New Deal and directly creating jobs for that paid well, of course, for low-skilled workers.
I think that attitude of that there isn't a structural problem. We need to have a better education. We need to, you know, job training is the solution to unemployment is, I think, had a lot of durability as an idea, broadly speaking, for society. I mean, I feel like it was discredited a little bit over the past couple of years, frankly. But so what we had was an issue where they were playing around with the inputs. What was really the problem was the function in terms of how we got the outputs.
It's also created problems in the field of education, right? Because, and I read a really good manuscript not long ago on this very topic by a political scientist named Daniel Moak. And in the field of education in the 1960s, the Johnson administration, of course, ponies up lots of money to fund improvements in education. But why did it do so? It did so in part. And I want to stress that federal funds for public education is a good thing. I don't oppose that at all. But the problem with the Johnson administration's effort in that regard was that the end game was to treat education as an economic escalator. That is a problem for teachers in the grand scheme of things, because how could education function to that desired end, right? How could primary and secondary education function in such a way that it could offset the transformation of the economies that children are forced to endure and young adults suffer through, if those local economies don't have a lot of decent paying jobs? There are profound limits for with respect to what educators can do. And when educators fail to achieve the impossible dream, and it is an impossible dream to burden educations with ending poverty, who do we blame for enduring poverty? We blame public school teachers as if they're bankrupting America by being remiss in their efforts to make America a fair and equitable society, but they can't, right? And again, we blame public school teachers, and this is the backdrop for high stakes testing and the erosion of public education as a citizenship right.
And so where do you think we are today in terms of society's, looking at these questions? I mean, on some level, right, just this week, right, we have incidents like what we saw in Central Park. We have incidents like what we saw in Minnesota. we have these incidents that probably take place, undoubtedly take place on a daily basis. It's just that, we happen to have video of it in these two instances. The reality of racism is there, but in terms of the way that we look at policy to address not necessarily racism but racial disparities, where are we in terms of that, do you think?
Well, I think, like every black and brown man I know, the Amy Cooper incident sent a chill up my spine, because I've had my own versions of that experience from my teenage years in New Haven, Connecticut, to the workplace as an adult. And I think the Amy Cooper incident, makes plain that racism is with us, which is certainly a point that I make in my book and make everywhere I can, frankly, and that there is a need and there remains a need for anti-discrimination policies, which even as such, anti-discrimination policies can't prevent someone like Amy Cooper from doing the despicable thing that she did, but they can certainly have some impact on people's experiences in the workplace. They can have an impact on people's experience in schools. They can have an impact on people's who can afford to buy a home in a given community, whether or not they have access to the home. So we absolutely positively, no ifs, ands, or buts about it, need fair housing legislation, which we have, anti-workplace and school discrimination, which we have. And I wouldn't have a problem building on that. But if our end game is to mitigate, let me take mitigate out. If our end game is to eliminate something known as black poverty. I'm not sure how we would do that without eliminating poverty in America for everyone. And there are a lot of reasons that I'm not sure how we would do that. The first and most obvious is just math. Blacks are 12.8% of the total population. I don't think there's ever been a time that 12.8% of a population that's comprised disproportionately of working class and poor people has ever won anything in a democracy, right? I mean, you have to have some sort of coalition in order to, for you know, that's larger than that group to win anything. And that's how it's been, obviously, since emancipation. And that's how it will be as long as blacks aren't 50+% of the population. So that's our first issue. The other issue, though, that's worth paying attention to is the limitations of anti-discrimination policy as a vehicle for upward mobility, right?
Right.
I absolutely have been a beneficiary of anti-discrimination policy, right? My parents are black middle-class professionals who bought their first home, I believe, in 1972. So that's about 4 years after the Civil Rights Act of 1968 made it possible for black people to be homeowners. Both my parents were the beneficiaries of affirmative action, which opened economic opportunities for them, and I downstream for them am a beneficiary of it. But if you look at what anti-discrimination policy has done in the absence of a class agenda, blacks between 1968 and 2016 have actually moved up in relative terms with respect to black household income. Black household income in 1968, I want to say, was in the 25th percentile. By 2016 or 2018, whatever, it was the 35th percentile. So blacks had moved up. Why didn't that eliminate the racial wage gap, right, or the wealth gap? Because the earning power of workers, the bottom 80 or 90% of workers, had either remained stagnant or declined. And so blacks moved up, yes, but they moved up in a context of decline for working people. So the real benefits aren't readily apparent, right? The real benefits were that relative increase, and it's a substantial increase. The earning power for, I believe, the 35th percentile, where blacks are, at least were before COVID-19, had dropped 30% since 1968. Whites moved up not as far in that context. They moved up from the 55th percentile to the 57th percentile. So they maintained relative advantage over blacks, but they also continued to experience a decline. If we just focus on disparities, then what, and ending disparities in this context, that's tantamount to demanding, a higher berth on a sinking ship.
Right.
That will certainly stave off drowning, but eventually we're still going to drown.
It's a bit of a race to the bottom type of situation.
Yes, yes. And we have to stop the race to the bottom, right? Because it's just not enough to move up in a context of overall decline.
Well, how important is this, is the relationship between race and capitalism to the argument you're making? Because it seems to me it's basically just that the argument you are making is that we have really two, in many respects, two separate problems, and one is the disparity may be a function of racism that exists, presumably that woman in Central Park, Cooper, it's not just, if she's savvy enough to leverage race in that way. And frankly, I'm not a clinical psychologist. I'm not a clinician, but there's a certain sociopathy involved in that. If she's willing to basically, swat this guy, and leverage the fact that he's black, because she knows that that's going to get the cops to come down and terrify him at best, maybe, who knows what she's doing in the workplace. Right. I mean, how many black people she's been able to basically, keep from advancing or, getting any deals, with like a similar tactic. But that ultimately, if we're talking about, you know, sort of broad strokes, that there's really has to be two sets of policies that don't even necessarily work in tandem.
Well, I think at least as far as Black and brown people are concerned, they would work in tandem. I think, you know, the origin of affirmative action was part and parcel of an anti-poverty strategy. And for Blacks who were well-positioned, let's say like my parents, to move with the transition from a blue-collar economy to a white-collar economy, affirmative action did quite a bit to mitigate poverty for those Black people. It also did a fair amount for, you know, a stratum of working class people, not all of them, but firemen, increased the number of Black firemen and Black cops and detectives and the like in the aftermath. And I'm sure an increase in the number of Black carpenters and electricians in the wake of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So anti-discrimination policies certainly have helped those Black people who were well positioned for white collar employment. But they just are not adequate for those policies, for those Blacks who aren't. And it would be pretty tough for someone who comes from, and it happens, and these are exceptional people, but it's pretty tough or quite a large mountain that we expect poor and working class Black people who, let's say, may come out of households without parents, without parental resources to help them make their way to college, not just financially, but also with respect to, having the kind of education that they could use to help prepare their kids for college. It's to expect poor and working class Black people to transition from, you know, poor neighborhoods with poor quality schools with parents who don't have a lot of formal education to white collar employment, that's not something that white people did, right? That's not something that the principal beneficiaries of, let's say, the National Labor Relations Act did, because those individuals, many of them did not have, you know, we're talking about the 30s, 40s, and even 50s, unionized workforce allowed a white population and a stratum of Blacks as well, but allowed a disproportionately large number of whites to transition from, again, the tenements to the suburbs. What that meant is that those people were paid a wage that afforded them comfort and independence, and the benefits of those wages were accrued by their offspring. And they moved to the suburbs in the post-war era, and their kids attend good quality schools in an era in which public higher education, the tuition in public higher education was either free or unbelievably cheap. And they were able then, their progeny were able to transition into the middle class. There is no mechanism like that for Black people today, right? And other poor and working class people to make that kind of transition today. And what we need is some mechanisms, and we can draw from history for a blueprint for this, but we need some mechanism to assist people who don't have a lot of formal education, whatever their race, to earn good wages that would enable them, again, that would afford them some security and stability and prospects for a better life for themselves and their offspring. And so this is a very long-winded way to say that I don't see the anti-discrimination policies and class-centered policies that redress inequities as two fully distinct things, at least for those of us who want to end racial disparities, and I'm one of them. Those things don't exist in worlds apart from each other. They're complementary and they're essential if we want to live in a more just and democratic society.
Dr. Torre Reed, the book is Toward Freedom, The Case Against Race Reductionism. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that book at majority.fm. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half. Do we have Michael on the line? Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, we give you extra content every day, and we give you the free show, free of ads. And that's the way we do it around here. If you don't have the resources to become a member and get the extra content, and you don't have to listen to the extra content. Sometimes people just like, I'm going to skip the interview. I'm just going to listen to the fun half today. Or sometimes I'm just going to listen to the interview and not the fun half. However you want to use it. Once you become a member, you can do whatever you want. If you want to listen to just the middle, like I'm going to listen to the last 15 minutes of the interview and the first 15 minutes of the fun half. I mean, it doesn't matter. Flexible in that way. But if you are going through some type of financial stress at this moment, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and we will hook you up. No one will be locked out because of finances. So join majorityreport.com or majorityreporters@gmail.com and we will take care of you. Also, our merch store is open, ladies and gentlemen, and our merch people have been, Brendan, is this fair? Have they been shocked by the response?
They have been, I think shocked is a good way to describe it. They've been very impressed with us and our fan base and their willingness to wear the swag. Yeah.
Yeah. But you
apparently we're doing better than a famous, nonprofit in their merch. So.
Well, I mean, come on.
Can I find out about this offline? I want to know who this famous nonprofit is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And maybe we'll talk about it in the fun half. Join the Majority Report.
Join the Majority Report. Find out who the famous nonprofit is. You can pick up our merch at shop.majorityreportradio.com. And our merch sellers, they were, you know, everything is all American made and all union made. And there's, you know, obviously in this era of COVID, where, you know, our shipping is a little bit slower and they were a little bit concerned about that. And they're like, do you think people will be okay? And I'm like, people been waiting 10 years for this merch. I think everybody will be fine. Also, don't forget amquickie.com every morning. Check it out. 6 minutes long. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Michael.
Yes, sir.
Look at you.
How are you, Sam? You know, it's getting really serious now.
Yeah.
Very bold mustache.
Believe me. There's a lot of controversy. I don't know if it's going to last the week. It might. It may. I don't know. Maybe it'll last an eternity. But
you have the gall, the chutzpah to do national media with like a 70s porn stash. You got to respect it.
I got a lot of feedback from... I did Hayes's program from this very seat, and I'm going to be on Melber's show, I think, maybe tomorrow night. And, I'm letting the mustache just, I may just not, you know, like.
It'll look like the movie where, like, Melber is trying to get you to stop gambling.
Right.
And you're.
You got to upgrade your Tinder profile, though, Sam.
Right. You can't be misleading.
I'm not sure
that
would be an upgrade. I'm not sure that would be an upgrade.
Well, you can't be misleading. Last night on TMBS, we did a deep dive. Surprisingly enough, or not surprisingly at all, no one has stepped out of more arms control agreements than the Trump administration. And his arms envoy has said that they are willing to spend China and Russia into an oblivion. In a new arms race for the 21st century.
Into oblivion?
Well, yeah, I guess that's the nice version of what we can do. So we've just stepped out of something called the Open Skies Treaty. So we did a deep dive on the state of arms control and, I mean, what they're doing to completely undermine the entire arms control system. Covered a bunch in the post game, including Iranian oil tankers on their way to Venezuela. And did a great interview with my buddy Dustin Guastalla from the Teamsters and Philly DSA on why Bernie lost and the bigger questions around that, and basically why candidates need to start being seated from labor unions and how that might actually work at a state and local level with some good examples from Pennsylvania. And I'd recommend people read his piece in Jacobin as well. Patreon.com/TMBS.
And folks, don't forget. Nomiki's Show. You can find it at patreon.com/Nomiki's Show and also Nomiki Const on YouTube. Check out the Antifada, patreon.com/the Antifada. New content. They load up like two or three times a week, I think. I'm not sure. Matt, what game are you going to be playing, and what classic piece of literature will you be listening to?
I am still playing Red Dead Redemption, and people who have followed my recent twitch.tv/literary hangover streams will have read this much of this big book here. This is The Fatal Environment, The Myth of the Frontier and the Age of Industrialization, 1800 to 1890 by Richard Slotkin, name dropped by Cornel West in the TMBS interview, to understand the sort of long line of what you could call fascism in America, and playing Red Dead Redemption to it. So twitch.tv/literary hangover. Very thematically appropriate, I promise.
At which part?
Just
is thematically appropriate with the literature, or the literature is thematically appropriate?
The video game set in the late West is thematically appropriate with learning about how, like, the factory
like
and the plantation.
It's like a food and wine pairing.
Exactly. Except it's all about
video
the West.
Games and audiobooks.
I tried to read Dostoevsky and listen to Stevie Wonder once. That was an interesting pairing.
I listened to Chopped and Screwed Chamillionaire while reading Brave New World in high school.
That totally works. That is, I would almost one-to-one, actually.
I would like to see you play the game and literally read the book simultaneously. Yeah. All right, folks. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920, or you can IM us on the IM.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report.
Sam will be with you shortly.